KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
The Week in Philly on KYW News Radio is recorded and edited every Friday afternoon. For the latest updates to any of the stories you're about to hear, listen to KYW News Radio anytime on your smart speaker or the Odyssey or iHeartRadio apps. Visit KYWNewsRadio.com or follow us on social media at KYW News Radio.
This is The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
Welcome to our weekly look at the stories that have been making headlines in Philadelphia and the region. My name is Matt Leon, and over the next hour, we will bring in KYW News Radio reporters and experts to break down the stories you have been talking about. This was the final week of budget hearings before Philadelphia City Council.
Once the budget hearings are over, that's when the real negotiations start.
Pat Loeb will tell us the state of play for the budget. Pennsylvania State Legislature moving several pieces of legislation dealing with artificial intelligence.
AI is moving a lot faster than government.
Jim Melwert will have that story. Then Connor Barkon will have the details of an ADL report on anti-Semitism in America.
That is the third highest total since tracking began.
We will talk with former KYW anchor and golf aficionado Ed Abrams about next week's PGA Championship at Aronimink.
Anytime you can have a major in this area, in the golf world, that's huge.
As big events descend on Philadelphia this year, concern increasing about human trafficking.
Many times these victims don't even know they're victims.
Kristen Johansson will have that story. And then John McDevitt will tell us about the Hollywood star who spoke to graduates this week at Temple.
It was really inspirational.
All that is ahead over the next hour. I hope you'll join us for The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio, and we will get started right after this. We start this edition of The Week in Philly talking city budget. This week, budget hearings wrapped up in Philadelphia City Council. And for more, let's bring in KYW City Hall Bureau Chief Pat Loeb. And Pat, Wednesday was the final day of hearings. And what did we hear?
Yes, it was the final day of budget hearings, and it was reserved for public testimony. And there were a group of city employees who are really upset about the continued understaffing. This is a phenomenon that started during COVID, and the city has made great strides, but they're still about 14% understaffed.
This surplus was built on the backs of social workers carrying triple caseloads and parks and rec staff who act as teachers, security, and babysitters, and prison staffing that's so low it's criminal.
Is it safe to say that the rideshare tax proposed by Mayor Sherelle Parker will be kind of the flashpoint, the biggest sticking point when it comes to coming to an agreement?
Yes. Well, really all of the taxes. And yes, there were people testifying about those taxes because they see them, you know, as adding to the unaffordability of their lives in the city. But Mayor Parker says, come on, we haven't raised property taxes in years. Philadelphia has held the rate steady, but it does need more income. You know, the school district is facing a structural deficit. And so she thinks that this is the way to do it. And she shows no sign of backing off, despite the, you know, people saying, well, you're just making my life harder by imposing this tax.
So what is the state of play with the budget at this point? Does it feel like it's going to pass? Is it going to be a long, drawn-out process from a vote standpoint? Where do you see things sitting right now?
Well, once the budget hearings are over, that's when the real negotiations start. And it is going to be a, you know, kind of a long process, but they have to come to some kind of an agreement by June 4th under the city charter so that they can pass it before they recess for the summer. And then the new fiscal year starts July 1st. Now, that's true at the state level, too. And somehow the state seems to take those deadlines as purely advisory. But Philadelphia is really good about meeting that deadline. It always has. And sometimes it's that last day before the vote is a very long day, but they always do make that deadline.
Also this week on Thursday, that set of bills kind of limiting how ICE can operate in Philadelphia, that set of bills became law but in a couple of different ways. Can you explain?
Sure. So this package of legislation was seven bills in all. Many of them were simply codifying provisions that are already in an executive order that was in place and being observed. There were a couple new provisions, and one of them in particular, the mayor did not sign the bill, but she didn't veto it. So it becomes law without her signature. And that is the provision that local, state, and federal law enforcement cannot disguise their identity with the use of masks or covered badges or unmarked cars. And the mayor said, you know, the law department says that will not fly, that similar legislation elsewhere has been struck down in court. The bill sponsors say they disagree. But what's interesting is I had the chance to talk to some DHS officials off the record about this and asked them how they felt about these bills becoming law. And they said, well, we don't really feel like anything's changed. They seem to be taking it in stride. But there had been a lot of speculation that the mayor might not sign these bills because she's been kind of low key about immigration. She's been asked about it repeatedly, and she always gives this answer that she's laser focused on moving the city forward and she won't let anything interfere with that. And so you'd have to read between the lines to understand what she means. But being an interpreter of the mayor for a while now, I would say what she means is she does not want to pick a fight with the Trump administration over immigration. But she does. And when she signed the bill, she sent a statement to city council saying she does admire and respect the immigrant community in Philadelphia. And she supports council's desire to keep them safe.
All right. Thank you very much, Pat. KYW City Hall Bureau Chief Pat Loeb joining us. We are just getting started. Much more of this edition of The Week in Philly is coming up straight ahead.
I think states across the country are trying to grapple with how to regulate AI, and I think that this bill is a great first step.
This is The Week in Philly, and there's lots to talk about out of Harrisburg. And for more, let's bring in KYW Suburban Bureau Chief Jim Melward. And Jim, a lot of movement in the legislature on the artificial intelligence front. And let's start with what we saw Wednesday in the state Senate. Movement to require advertisers to clearly mark pictures or videos made with AI. Tell me more.
Yes, a bipartisan bill from Western PA Democrat State Senator Nick Piscitano and Montgomery County Republican Tracy Pennycook. It would require advertisers to clearly mark any AI-generated ads that create, in Pennycook's words, a false consumer perception of a product.
That disclosure must appear at the first instance where the synthetic content is presented. It must also appear in the same medium as the synthetic content and must be difficult to remove.
Pennycook says there's a carve-out for First Amendment-protected content like satire, fiction, or parody.
So what is next here for this legislation?
Since it moved out of committee unanimously, it heads to the Senate floor, and a similar bill moved out of committee in the state House. So I would say it's safe to expect to see this, a combination of the two bills or one of the bills, finalized in the coming months.
Now, in the state House, we saw legislation make a big step forward that would regulate the use of artificial intelligence in healthcare. What's happening here?
This one comes from licensed physician, Democratic State Rep. Arvin Venkat, who says he sees firsthand the value of AI in healthcare in his practice, but he calls AI a black box, with patients and healthcare regulators unsure when or how AI is being used or what patient data is being used to train AI models. His bill would require disclosure of when AI is used in healthcare decisions and an annual verification of human oversight, and that all privacy and anti-discrimination laws are being followed in what he calls common sense guide rails.
For our constituents, for patients, for the insured, I think it is absolutely critical that we move forward with this legislation as a framework of what we want to see in requirements related to artificial intelligence in healthcare.
So what is next for this legislation?
Five Republicans joined all Democrats in voting in favor to advance this bill out of the State House Communications and Technology Committee. But even those who voted in support say they think it still needs work. Some say it's too narrowly focused, should more broadly address AI in healthcare. Others say they worry that it could stifle progress of promising technology of something that could be extremely helpful in healthcare. So this heads to the House floor, but there will be amendments and other discussions around it before it passes the House.
Now, even more legislation focusing on AI, and specifically, this is the darker side of artificial intelligence, making sure school districts report the use of AI-generated deepfake nude or inappropriate images of other classmates, and make sure that these districts are reporting this to police. What are the details here?
Yeah, this is definitely something that law enforcement and school districts have been dealing with, and the bill addressing it cleared committee and also passed the state house, so it's on the way to the state senate. It would basically include AI deepfake child sexual abuse material made by other teenagers to what's already covered by mandatory reporting for teachers, coaches, or any other list of jobs where they're called mandatory reporters and must immediately report any reasonable belief or can face criminal liability. Prime sponsor of this bill, Lancaster County Democrat Nikki Rivera, says she felt action was needed after there was a pretty large scandal involving this at Lancaster Country Day School.
We had the unfortunate victimization of almost 50 students at one school because of AI deepfakes, putting people's faces on bodies and sending them out and humiliating people.
Now, Rivera says the delay in reporting likely led to other students being victimized. Bucks County Republican State Rep. Kristen Marcell is a co-sponsor of the bill. She says she saw firsthand the need for immediate reporting when 11 girls in the Council Rock District were victimized by classmates using AI.
So all this legislation coming together kind of piecemeal dealing with artificial intelligence AI, could we eventually kind of see this all regulated together? I have no idea what it would look like, but this is such a oncoming freight train that affects so many things. Could we eventually see some sort of artificial intelligence rule book or something like that?
Well, that's the big question here. And these are just kind of feeling around the edges. And as quickly as AI is moving, for example, Anthropic's models already writing code for itself, these bills have been discussed for the better part of a year, if not more than a year, and they're just getting to them now. So AI is moving a lot faster than government. And the other issue here is these are state governments, and you hear Pennsylvania legislators saying that this needs to be done at the federal level. This cannot be done at the state level, but we have a Congress right now that is incapable of doing anything, which has been frustrating state lawmakers. The other scary part of this is that you're seeing lawmakers in other states who are trying to come up with some kind of regulation, some kind of pumping the brakes on this until we get an idea of what it means. You're seeing large amounts of money go into defeating them in elections, which is creating a chilling effect on other lawmakers, not just in those states, but across the country, especially at the state level where that money is so crucial to get elected. So it really needs to be done at the federal level, but there's just no appetite or no pressure for it at this point, and nothing's getting done.
All right. Thank you very much, Jim. That's KYW Suburban Bureau Chief Jim Melward joining us. We've got more to get to on this edition of The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio. I hope you'll stay with us. It's The Week in Philly, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
When we look at the level of violence that has occurred, the level of threats to the Jewish community that has occurred, it's one of the reasons we continue to put out this data.
We continue on this edition of The Week in Philly, and a new report from the Anti-Defamation League tells an alarming story about anti-Semitism in America. And for more, let's bring in KYW's Connor Barkon. First off, Connor, tell us about this report. What is it?
Yeah, Matt, the ADL has been tracking anti-Semitism across the United States officially since 1979 in their annual audit of anti-Semitic incidents. The report comes out each year after the ADL has been able to review reports that have been made to them over the course of the last year. They take the first few months of each year to determine what should be included in the audit.
So what does the report show with regards to anti-Semitism?
Well, in 2025, the ADL traced 6,274 anti-Semitic incidents nationally. That is the third highest total since tracking began.
What classifies as an incident in this report, and are like all incidents thrown into the same bucket?
No, definitely not. So, you know, there are violent incidents and then there are nonviolent incidents as well. The ADL has set standards to determine what classifies as an anti-Semitic incident and what does not. For example, if someone spray paints Free Gaza on the side of a school, that is not considered an anti-Semitic incident that would be included in the audit. And that is because someone is committing a crime. However, they're not necessarily attacking Jews by making a statement like that. Now, if that same statement was spray painted on the side of a synagogue, then that would be included in the audit and would be considered anti-Semitism because it's targeting a large group of Jews for a purpose. So that's just one example, but there are certain standards like that that the ADL has set to compile all of these incidents.
So give us some context here. You said third highest rate since they started tracking it. How big of an increase year to year are we talking about? And does the ADL provide any thoughts as to why we've seen such an increase?
So just to be clear, the number of incidents in 2025 decreased from 2024 by about 3,000, but it's still the third highest since tracking has began, and violent incidents are up. There were three deadly attacks against Jews, according to the report. You may remember two of them were very high profile. Two people were killed near the Capitol Jewish Museum after an event there in 2025. You know, as far as why, the report doesn't go into details about why, but you can say that this is a driving force is definitely opposition to not only the war in Gaza, but a stance against the Israeli government that has really become strong since October 7th.
What we've talked about has been kind of at the macro level for the entire country, but I also know this report had some detailed info at the state and city level. What did we learn about Pennsylvania and Philadelphia specifically?
Most of Pennsylvania's incidents happened in the state's most populated cities, according to Regional Director of ADL Philadelphia, Andrew Goretsky.
Philadelphia and Pittsburgh did account for more than half of the incidents across Pennsylvania, with Philadelphia having 106 incidents and Pittsburgh having 43.
The ADL found 281 anti-Semitic incidents that occurred in Pennsylvania in 2025. And one, of course, was an attack at the governor's mansion where Cody Ballmer targeted Governor Josh Shapiro and his family. And in fact, the damaged mansion was the cover image of this year's report.
In addition to all this data the report provides, are there any ideas offered to help address this anti-Semitism?
More funding, right? I mean, that's basically what they're calling for. The ADL is calling for an increase in federal security funding for houses of worship, and it's pushing for the passage of the Sacred Act, and that would create a buffer zone where harassment of worshipers would not be allowed.
All right. Thank you very much, Connor. KYW's Connor Barkon joining us. We need to step away. More of The Week in Philly coming your way right after this. The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers, proud sponsor of the KYW News Radio studios. Bring on the fun and bring home a new Honda with a great deal on your favorite Honda vehicles and finally take that road trip you've been dreaming of. Now's the time to check out the Honda Civic at HRV from Honda, the 2025 Kelley Blue Book's KBB.com best value brand.
Nearly 100 years old, and what's amazing is that it still is a championship level golf course.
What's really going to be an amazing week of golf and with all the biggest names in the world playing.
Welcome back to The Week in Philly, and the region is getting ready for one of the premier golf events to descend on the area. Next week, the PGA Championship will be played at Aronimink Golf Club in Newtown Square. Now, as you can imagine, lots of buzz surrounding this, and for more, let's bring in former KYW News Radio Morning Drive anchor and golf aficionado Ed Abrams. And Ed, wonderful to talk to you, and for people who aren't golf junkies, give us some context on how big it is for Aronimink to host a tournament of this caliber.
It's big. Anytime you can have a major in this area, in the golf world, that's huge. It actually won't be the first for Aronimink. They had a PGA there back in 1962. Gary Player won that one. And they've hosted a few tour events down through the years. But it's a big deal.
What are you looking for and what should fans be looking for next weekend?
The thing that I am going to be most interested in seeing is what the final scores are going to be.
The last time the PGA Tour was at Aronimink, I'm going to have to look at my notes because my memory is not what it used to be, but that was a 2018 BMW Championship. Justin Rose and Keegan Bradley got into a playoff, and Bradley won it. But their winning scores at the end of regulation, four rounds, were 20 under par. And Aronimink is hard. You know, and 20 under is pretty amazing. Whenever I've played Aronimink, it just beats you up because it plays so long and long and long. And the green complexes are among the things that make Aronimink so interesting. There are other things, but I think it won't even be close to 20 under, personally. But I'll be interested to see.
When you think of moments in this area in big tournaments that Philadelphia golf fans will remember, or people that are just getting acclimated to golf at this level around here should maybe look into, think about, and find out, what do you think of?
Well, the Opens at Merion had a lot of moments. It was 1971. Lee Trevino beat Jack Nicklaus. They were close going into the final round, and there was a thing where Trevino pulled a rubber snake out of his bag and threw it on the ground, and they had some fun with that. But Trevino won that day. He held off Jack. And that was big. My favorite story of all is, you know, over my shoulder here, that iconic picture of Ben Hogan hitting a long iron into the 18th green at Merion. His par on that hole enabled him to get into a three-way playoff the next day, which Hogan won. And he won that Open like a year and a half after he nearly lost his life in a car crash. There was a local pro who was a Hogan fan who was following him that day. And I met this guy down in Sunset Beach, North Carolina, where we used to go on vacation when the kids were young every year. And he was right there when Hogan hit that shot. And he said the crowd surged forward after the shot, because back then the galleries were in the fairways behind the players. And he said, I saw this divot that he made, and it was the most beautiful divot I've ever seen. And he picked up the dirt, the divot, wrapped it in a handkerchief, took it home, put it in a freezer, took it out a few years later and put it on his bookshelf. And 39 years after that, he sent the divot to Ben Hogan. And Hogan's secretary opened the package, you know, and walked in and said, Mr. Hogan, you're not going to believe this. He said, and Ben Hogan sent me a wonderful letter. And I said, well, can you send me a copy? Because I wanted to kind of affirm this story, number one, but he did. So, and Hogan at the time said he was amazed and looking at how he was going to be able to display this divot in the trophy case at Colonial Country Club in Fort Worth. So that was kind of fun. And that's what that shot is all about to me. I mean, just that somebody would take the time to do that. I mean, that takes my obsession with golf into another whole nother stratosphere, you know?
Well, and it's good to know that if you do get a divot, the proper protocol is to freeze it, because I don't think that ever would have occurred to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Ed, thanks so much. That is former KYW anchor Ed Abrams joining us. We've got more to get to on this edition of The Week in Philly. Don't go anywhere.
Even if you think, oh, not my kid, my kid's too smart for that, listen, they can fall to trap like anybody else can to something like this.
Welcome back to The Week in Philly, and we are getting ready for what should really be an extraordinary summer of big events in Philadelphia. The semi-quincentennial, the World Cup, events that will bring people from all over the world to the city. And while there is a ton of good that comes from that, there are also some serious concerns, like an increased threat of human trafficking. Now, for more on this, let's bring in KYW Crime and Justice reporter Kristen Johansson. And Kristen, first off, what are experts and police worried about with all these events coming to Philadelphia? And how does it raise the threat level? And what do the schemes used to lure children, lure people, look like?
A lot of times they're using social media, which I know is something that everybody talks about, but that social media is obviously a big one. We've heard the stories about Roblox and even on Instagram and whatnot, but a lot of the times it's just, you know, show up here and we're going to take your pictures, or show up here and we're going to give you work to do or something. So it's kind of luring them in that way. The other thing is, and this kind of happens on a scale that isn't when it's a big event, when it's something that is more slow kind of lore of the teenagers, but also of the parents, like people who act, they said, like the best boyfriends in the world that have maybe the most money, maybe just kind of grooming not only that teen or that child, but also the parents, saying the perfect thing, saying that they're going to, you know, take them somewhere, do something for them, and kind of like love bomb them in such a way. They can be then recruiting some of those teens or some of those children into this, basically this network. So there's a lot of different kinds of schemes. The biggest one, obviously, is social media and online. And it's going to become, they fear, more prevalent now that we kind of have the eyes of the world are going to be on this region for the 250th and for the World Cup and the MLB. That just kind of brings, you could say, the bad guys to the area, because there's going to be more opportunity for them to sell essentially sex, or for them to sell labor.
Is it possible to have data on how much we see human trafficking spike when events like these come to an area? Or is it so nebulous, it's really hard to put hard numbers on it?
It is hard to put hard numbers on it, because many times, you know, both law enforcement and the advocates say that many times these victims don't even know they're victims, or survivors don't know they're survivors. They don't know that they're being trafficked. They're just kind of, it's not like that, you know, jump out of a car, like grab a child. It's a very slow process sometimes of luring their kids in. So it's really hard to exactly track how many kids, or how many people, you could say, even young girls, are being trafficked, because it's a very definitive terminology, like definition of what human trafficking is. But a lot of people or victims don't see themselves as a trafficked victim. They see themselves as a willing accomplice, like, no, I'm doing this because I want to do this. They see this as autonomy.
Are most of the children targeted, the victims targeted in situations like this, are they people that live here and they are targeted, or are they people coming to this area and they're targeted because they're in a new place, an unfamiliar place, or is it both situations?
It's both situations, but it's probably a little bit more or less the people that are here, right? The number one phrase that they've said is like, most trafficked victims sleep in their own bed. So it's going to be this is where the events are happening. This is where they're going to be trying to target children or teens that think that they're just doing something that they want to do because it's kind of like when you're an adult, you see all the dangers for your child that are around you, especially when they're young, when they're running down the street or they're running out, you see all the dangers. For them, they don't see any of the danger. And that is true when they're even teenagers. They think they're kind of safe because they've had that safety bubble that nothing can happen to them. So they don't see that these things are dangerous out there when somebody's offering them something. And then they're just slowly kind of getting lured in, and essentially they become a human trafficking victim.
Are there signs to look out for that something is amiss, things that parents or loved ones should keep an eye out? And how are there ways people can be proactive to prevent this?
Yes. So many areas there. First, when it comes to sex trafficking or human trafficking in that form, a lot of times when you see, like if you're just seeing your kids and they have either, you know, two phones, they're very possessive of their phone, or they're even coming in with new things you don't know how they got them. So they all of a sudden have brand new sneakers and you're like, well, where'd you get those sneakers? Or they have new video games and you don't really know where they got this money or to buy the new video games or how. And it's just like new and accumulating things are happening. A lot of times for girls, young girls, there's a lot of lashes are a big deal and getting your nails done. And you don't know how they're able to afford lashes or nails or getting their hair done or whatever. You can't understand where they got this money. Those are almost exact signs, I say, of somebody trying to at least groom them into being a victim if they are not already a victim. I know my mom always did diary checks when I was a kid just to, you know, I guess check in on me. And so, you know, doing random phone checks, they say, is also a way to kind of handle this and see who they're talking to. And also they're being very secretive. They're just kind of like all of a sudden kind of going away, or they always get rides somewhere. They always have a ride, or they're always using like Ubers or whatnot. The flip side of this is when you have labor trafficking, is having these kind of job posts where it all seems kind of too good to be true. It's show up here for this day of work and you're going to get paid $200 or something like that. Those can be signs as well. So it's very much, they say, for parents to check into these places where their kids are being told to basically show up. And let's say there's like a parking, you know, you're going to help with parking with this. Make sure that they have all the paperwork, they're connected to the event that may be happening, and that you know where they are. They have their ID, you have their, you know, the company's information, who their manager is, the names, et cetera, and really dig into it. And it can happen to anyone. It can happen to any suburban kid. Even if you think, oh, not my kid, my kid's too smart for that. Listen, we all love our kids. They can fall to trap like anybody else can to something like this.
All right. Thank you very much, Kristen. That's KYW crime and justice reporter Kristen Johansson joining us. We need to take a break. More of The Week in Philly is coming up.
But here's what Philadelphia teaches you, and also Temple University. You keep walking past the doubt. You keep walking past the fear. You keep walking until the dream catches up with you.
Final segment on this edition of The Week in Philly, and it is college graduation season. On Wednesday, Temple University held its graduation, the 139th commencement ceremony in school history, and the keynote speaker was a two-time Oscar Award nominee. And for more on this, let's bring in KYW's John McDevitt. John, who was it?
Coleman Domingo addressed the graduating class at Temple University's Liacouras Center. Coleman went to Temple for a couple of years. He didn't graduate. He went there for journalism in the late 80s. But he's now Temple made because he received a doctorate, honorary doctorate, at this ceremony. For those who don't know, Domingo's an award-winning actor, a playwright, a director, a producer. He was on Broadway. He acted in TV shows and movies like Fear of the Walking Dead, Euphoria, Lincoln, The Color Purple, and most recently, Michael. He plays Michael Jackson's father, Joe.
So what was his message to the graduates?
But, you know, it was really inspirational. Number one, he was so appreciative of his friends. He singled out a couple people in his speech, how much they added to his journey.
And when I tell you, when you take that journey, you take it with the people that are in this room, you're going to be friends forever. You're going to watch each other grow. You're going to have children. You're going to move. You're going to fall in love. You're going to fall out of love.
He talked about the good old days, hanging out at the food trucks, at the student activity center.
I learned a lot out by the trucks in front of SAC, where most of my friends hung out.
He wrote a love letter to Philadelphia and Temple University.
Philadelphia, a city that teaches you how to stand your ground and still keep your heart open. And standing here with you at Temple University, I feel the electricity of that same grit, that same tenderness, and that same refusal to be small.
It was very, like, very real and super cool to see him up there receiving the doctorate.
And when you talk about friendship, you are one of the people that falls under that umbrella as you went to college with him, right? Tell me more.
Yeah. It was the late 80s. It was just cool just to kind of just touch base again. I asked him, like, how do you recognize people 40 years later?
You recognize people by their eyes and by their laugh. I noticed you immediately. I was like, oh, John, exactly. Well, because I took a picture of you years ago and I developed. You'll have to show it to your fan base.
He took a picture of me with my late 80s hairdo and for a photojournalism class, and he actually developed it, you know, in the dark room and all that good stuff. And I actually had it. I took a picture of a picture. I don't carry that picture around. And I showed him, and he goes, I remember taking that, and he laughed at it, and it was, and he said, you're the only person that knows that about me. Like, you know, we're all just so proud of him. You know, he didn't graduate. He was there for like 2 years, working two jobs when he was at Temple. He just followed his heart and his dreams and moved to San Francisco. He worked at this for a long time. It was really until like the Fear of the Walking Dead is when he, I guess, was kind of like known. And that wasn't so long ago, right? So I also joked with him. I said, like, you're like a fine bottle of wine. I mean, the older you get, the more successful you get. You get better with age. And, you know, he laughed and was cool. And, I mean, he's super famous now. He's like, you know, friends with Oprah. He lives in Malibu. He has like celebrity friends. And it's just like, it was cool to kind of like, just, it was a real moment.
Would you have projected big things for him in college?
You know, he was very quiet, super shy, very kind of like artsy, walking around with cameras on, you know, around his neck, and but super kind, super friendly. But yeah, I think we all wish the best for one another. And it was just cool to, like, you know, and he was asking about, like, everyone there. Oh, what are you doing now? You know, have you seen this person? Or so, yeah, we're happy for him. And yeah, he's quiet, but, like, you know, dreams come true, right?
All right. Thank you very much, John. KYW's John McDevitt joining us. And that will do it for this edition of The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. This week's episode was produced by Sabrina Boyd-Circa and Brian Seltzer. My name is Matt Leon. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your weekend.